Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Laurie Levinson, who holds the David W. Burcham Chair in Ethical Advocacy at the Loyola University School of Law. Prior to joining Loyola Law School, she served for 8 years as an assistant United States attorney in Los Angeles, and she's written widely on criminal law, focusing both on criminal procedure and on the relationship between the law and the media. Welcome to Background Briefing, Laurie Levinson.
Thank you so much.
Well, thanks for joining us, Laurie. And do you think that Donald Trump, in making this statement on the first day of jury deliberation in Robert Mueller's first big trial against Paul Manafort, Donald Trump said to the media from the lawn of the White House, "I think the whole Manafort trial is very sad. I think it is a very sad day for our country. He happens to be a very good person, and I think it's very sad what they've done to Paul Manafort." Does that rise to jury tampering?
I don't think it was appropriate by the president, but I don't think it probably rises to the level of legal jury tampering, in part because, frankly, we've had other presidents or political leaders who have made comments about ongoing cases. Again, not appropriate, but it happens. And second, because the judge has instructed these jurors not to pay attention to what's in the media, even if it's said by President Trump. So it does seem to be a type of manipulation, but hopefully the jurors have said that's not what we're going to decide this case on.
But previous presidents like Nixon weighed in on the Charles Manson case, saying Manson was guilty. That was hardly a news flash. This is a case that directly involves Donald Trump, surely. This is his campaign manager, and it could lead unraveling more about his legal jeopardy.
I think that's right. I think he has a tremendous self-interest in the case, and actually it's just highlighted by these types of remarks. But I don't think that his actual impact on the jury is something that's going to be easy to prove. And, you know, again, in what he said, this is sad. I think he's a good man. It comes shy of saying, and it would be inappropriate or illegal or against justice for you to convict him. He wants to send a message without taking the responsibility of really impacting the jury.
So is there a legal distinction between jury tampering and trying to influence the jury?
In some ways there are. We really reserve jury tampering for cases where people have direct contact with jurors. We've had cases in the past where jurors have had things mailed to them. The judges have said that's not enough for jury tampering. Jury tampering is that one-on-one contact directly, not things that are filtering through the news that may impact the jury.
Well, on the first day of the Manafort trial, Donald Trump did speak out. He tweeted out that Manafort was being treated worse than Al Capone. And, of course, I don't think Donald Trump was aware of the irony of that, since Al Capone was charged with tax evasion, which is largely what Mueller is prosecuting Manafort for. So this wasn't the first time, by the way, that he spoke out.
No, I mean, basically, you know, people just sort of roll their eyes and say that's Trump. It's hyperbole. You know, it's something that the court has the duty to protect against, whether it be in screening the jurors, who they're listening to, whether they're following those types of tweets, reminding the jurors that should not enter into their decision making. But in the end, it's something that often prosecutors just have to deal with, and it's not an easy situation. I think we're seeing that prove true in this case, where the deliberations are going on longer than I'm sure that Mr. Mueller is comfortable with.
And again, I'm speaking with Laurie Levinson, who holds the David W. Burcham Chair in Ethical Advocacy at the Loyola University School of Law. And prior to joining Loyola Law School, she served for 8 years as an assistant U.S. attorney in Los Angeles, and she's written widely on criminal law, focusing both on criminal procedure and on the relationship between the law and the media. And it's in this case, though, the judge, T.S. Ellis, chose not to sequester the jury, even though he himself apparently has been personally threatened and is under the protection of U.S. marshals. So is that unusual?
Well, it's not unusual not to sequester jurors anymore. We used to do it much more, but we frankly can't afford it now. It's extremely expensive. So we operate under this myth that the jurors are just not going to pay attention. I think the last time we saw a major case sequestered was the OJ case, and people still question that. The issue is whether we can have fair trials where jurors do their duty and they're not influenced by political figures or anyone else. This is being called into question, but in some ways, it's some of the remarks that were going on inside the courtroom, even by the judge himself, that could have a greater impact than even what was being said on Twitter.
Well, when the judge really went after the prosecutors, I think on a couple of occasions, and he had to be corrected, but there isn't the prosecution doesn't get an appeal, do they?
That's right. I mean, that's why it's so damaging. You know, the judge's control of the courtroom and the judge maintaining a neutrality is really key to the case because jurors, in my experience, want to please. And so maybe there are jurors out there who want to please Trump, but it's more likely that there are jurors who are looking for cues from the judge. So when the judge says you can't prosecute somebody because they wear fancy suits or they're rich, that in many ways did undercut the prosecution's case here. And even though the judge took some of it back, the lingering impact of that is something we won't know. If the prosecutors lose, they don't get a second chance. This may end up being a mistrial, and they can learn from that and how they present the case the next time. And the judge can learn from it in terms of how he reacts to the evidence.
But it only takes one juror for a mistrial, right?
It does. They have to have a unanimous verdict in order to have a verdict in this case, whether it be a conviction or acquittal. So for a three-day deliberation with multiple meetings between the judge and the parties, it looks like something is hanging this up from being unanimous either direction.
Well, let's do the math. Donald Trump has something, 30 to 40% support in the country. So whatever that percentage is, let's divide that by 12 with the 12 jurors. It's not unlikely that one or two of those jurors are Trump supporters.
Well, no, it's not unlikely at all. And that would have to be one of the biggest concerns the prosecutors had from day one, although it is unlikely in that jurisdiction, which I think is a jurisdiction that was not known as a heavily Trump-supported area. But as you pointed out, it only needs one person who's saying, you know, I'm going to be the hero. And it may be just in looking at the evidence. In all fairness, the jurors get to look at the evidence and decide how convinced they are. And another challenge the prosecutors had in this case is that they had to rely on somebody who was cooperating, and the defense did a very effective job about making the trial about him and not about Manafort. So this case was one that a lot of people thought was slam dunk, because if you follow the money, Manafort looks really guilty. But if you focus on all these other issues, it might be enough to raise that reasonable doubt.
Well, though, I mean, it's still, if there is a mistrial, and if it only takes one person, and if that person turns out to be sympathetic to Trump, and if, because they're not sequestered, and I can't see why they wouldn't know about what's happening in the outside world, that Trump calling Manafort a great guy and that he was getting a raw deal could have influenced the outcome. And that, to my mind, it could well have been why Trump did it. I mean, some people think it was off the cuff, that's who he is. But on the other hand, for all of the criticism that's leveled against Trump, and I'm guilty of it myself, and even his own protege has written a book calling him unhinged, he's very canny, and he's fighting in a very, gloves-off kind of street-brawling Roy Cohn kind of way, is he not, against the law? He's like, this is a man who's one step ahead of the sheriff, and he's fighting hard.
Right. And, I don't disagree with he shows tremendous disrespect for the law. He has shown that in many different ways, whether it be this case or Joe Arpaio, who he pardoned. There are so many ways that he has just thumbed his nose on what many other people in the criminal justice system say, you should follow the law. I'm not disregarding the fact that if there were sort of a smoking gun, or in these days a smoking tape, where Trump says, watch me, I'm going to try to impact the jury by letting loose these tweets, maybe that would be a different situation. But without that, we're sort of stuck in a situation where he has a big voice that could make its way to the jurors, And we ordinarily would trust the jurors to sort of say, he doesn't get to decide. Trump is not doing the job. But if you don't have jurors who think that way, then it can be a problem.
And in the Paul Manafort trial, what did you think of the fact that his defense lawyers did not call any witnesses for the defense? This has led to speculation that Manafort is relying on the prospect of Trump pardoning him.
Oh, I think that's certainly one possibility. I think there are a couple reasons for that. One, I think they did want to make the case about the prosecution's case and that they didn't believe that they had proved it beyond a reasonable doubt. I think every witness they called could be vulnerable and actually backfire against them. And I do think that they believe there's a safety net in this case. And the safety net is the same person out there saying, don't prosecute Paul Manafort, he's a wonderful guy. He happens to also be the president who has the power to pardon. So logically, why put on a case? It could only hurt you when you may not need it at all.
Well, Manafort's lawyers, by the way, praised Trump's statement. And could they be in any way censured for that? Aren't they officers of the court?
They're officers of the court, but they have the right, the First Amendment right, to make statements as long as there's not a substantial probability that would materially affect the decision-making. And they're going to stand by the same thing, which is to say my client is a great guy. There's nothing that the president said that isn't true, and that the prosecution is basically overzealous in bringing the case. I don't know of any, you know, state bar or disciplinary committee that would say to a defense lawyer, you don't have the right to say that on behalf of your client. They'd have to go much more into the facts to be vulnerable to some type of censure based upon that.
Well, it's pretty clear that Trump is, you mentioned, we talked about the pardoning. He's circumvented the Office of Pardon Attorney in the White House. So he's not following normal procedures. And he pardoned these Oregon ranchers who were close to the Bundys. And he also, as you mentioned, he's pardoned Sheriff Joe Arpaio. He also pardoned Dinesh D'Souza. And he's already talked about pardoning himself. One of the comments that I've heard from some of the White House reporters is that with Donald Trump, it's like he's discovering these new toys in this big playground, the ultimate reality TV casting in the world to be president of the United States. And some of the favorite toys of late he's discovered where he gets instant gratification is pardoning, tariffs, and pulling people's security clearances.
Right. I actually think it's, even though people are amused, I find it particularly frightening because it calls into question even our constitutional setup, how much power the executive branch should have. I think that when the framers put in our system, they believed that we would have an executive that would basically use those tools for the benefit of the nation, not to protect himself, even though that was a possibility. But with what President Trump's doing, it could cause what we call the constitutional crisis. It could cause, if we had a different Congress, for them to take a look and say, should he remain in office? The problem here is that we don't have any counterbalance. We don't have any other group in government sort of saying, you've gone too far. These are important questions. It worries me that when we have government or justice by tweet, because these are really serious issues.
Well, from day one, though, if you talk about pulling the security clearances, he's going after the very people who briefed him on the 6th of January, 2017, just before he was inaugurated, who told him about Russian interference in no uncertain manner with great detail. And that's what's frightening is that he seems to be, it's almost like King Canute trying to defy the tide. He's trying to defy the reality of what they've told him.
And there are a lot of questions. Why is that the case? Is he trying to protect himself? Does he just not see the reality? Is he the one person who's right when he says there wasn't Russian interference? I'm really hoping that we continue to move forward to get the answers to this. It is extremely troubling to me when he tries to invade the independence of prosecutors, especially a special counsel, because right now that's the only method we have to find out, quote, the truth. Now, I know we had some discussion this weekend about whether there is a real truth, but there are facts to be found. And I still think there's a value in finding those facts.
But could Trump extend the pulling of security clearances to Mueller himself and Mueller's investigator and their investigators and thereby shut down the investigation?
You know, hypothetically, is that possible? It might be, but we've heard at least some members, even of the Republican Party, say that's where they will draw the line. So what you're pointing out is crucial. We think we have, quote, a legal system, but we have a legal system that is really infused with politics and ethics, and we're on a whole new game with President Trump when it comes to those issues.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, there's an interesting article by Bernadette Myler at Stanford Law School about Trump's use and abuse of pardon power. And she says that his manner calls to mind Nazi jurist Carl Schmitt's statement that sovereign is he who decides on the exception. In other words, whoever declares that the rule of law doesn't apply at the same time announces himself as the highest power in the state. And this idea was used to justify the grant of emergency powers to the German president under Article 48 of the Weimar Constitution, enabling Hitler's rise to power. And therefore, if Trump is pardoning, using his pardon as exception, and in pardoning Manafort, he would be using it to declare himself sovereign and his associates above the law. I'm not suggesting that Trump's in any way Adolf Hitler, but there is clearly a dangerous analogy there.
I think it's one that we really have to think about. I know a lot of people say it couldn't happen here, it couldn't happen now, that's too extreme. But I do think we have to learn from history, whether it be here in the United States or in other nations. It's a problem when one person has too much power or thinks they have too much power. And, you know, whether you think that they're doing it for, you know, ignorant reasons or intentional reasons, we've seen this before. So I think a lot of the pushback against Trump is the idea that he wants too much power. He wants too much power in a lot of realms. For the president, they need a lot of power, whether they be commander-in-chief in some areas. But we do have a separation of powers, and the justice system at least is one that should be separate, and we're having the mingling of it happen right
now. Sure. Well, Lori Levinson, I thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And again, Lori Levinson is holds the Berkham Chair of Ethical Advocacy at Loyola University. And I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Lady dressed in white with a man.